there. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Henrik, and we are, as always, happy to have you with us wherever you are from. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com. It's our websites where you can learn more about our program, investigations and analysis into a lot of different topics. I hope you're having a good day so far and that you're ready to take a glimpse into the flip side of the new green religion. Steve Gorham is Executive Director of the Climate Science Coalition of America, an independent, non-political association of scientists, engineers, and concerned citizens dedicated to informing the American people about the realities of climate science. Steve is author of the new book, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism, Mankind and Climate Change Mania, now with over 100,000 copies in print. He is also a speaker on the environment and energy, a former engineer and business executive. Well, hi, Steve. Welcome. Thank you for taking the time joining us today. It's great to have you with us.
Great to join you, Henrik. I'm excited to discuss this important topic with you.
You bet. Now, great job on the book, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism, something that I wish every school kid and adult could get access to and read, of course, to get a somewhat of a more balanced to a very unbalanced picture here. But, you know, we are no strangers to questioning anthropogenic global warming or climate change, as they call it now, on the program. But there is a reason that we need to return to this topic again and again and again, because no matter how many people we get on the program to try to balance this question, this point, people are victims of, you know, repetitiveness in the media, you know, and that includes some alternative media as well, by the way. And some people, they kind of relapse. They fall back into feeling the need to change policies, politics, and economics on behalf of climate change. But no matter how much science you discuss, it seems to be a barrier of belief in the way. And this is why some people now talk about the subjects like it's a religion. So I wanted to get into first, Steve, ask you a little bit about the word that you use, climatism, and if you would define that for us, and if you, just like we then, kind of see that this is an ideology today that's basically is based on belief as opposed to science.
Well, it is, and I chose the word because I believe what is going on is an ideology. Climatism I define as the belief that man-made greenhouse gases are destroying Earth's climate, and it is the dominant believed or taken position in the world today. Today we still have 192 of 194 heads of state of the nations of the Earth that say they believe in the theory of man-made climate change or dangerous global warming. All of our major scientific organizations, the United Nations, leading universities around the world, the news media, Fortune 500 companies have all pretty much signed up to this idea that man is causing climate change and that we need to take appropriate measures to try and mitigate those effects. So it is the dominant situation, but the really remarkable thing is that once a person gets into the details, looks at the trends and the scientific information, we find that almost every aspect of this theory is flawed and incorrect. So really an astonishing situation.
It sure is. And so before we get it, we have a lot of different segments to this, of course, that we want to discuss. And before we get to the science part of this, maybe you can just enlighten our audience a little bit as to your background and your interest in this subject overall. You've been teaching about this and you've become, I guess, a little bit of a heretic, if we can call it that, then in the climate change community, right?
Yes, I am. I'm actually a communicator. I'm a speaker. I'm a researcher of the topic of environmental science, of the topic of man-made warming, of renewable energy and public policy. I don't claim to be a scientist. I rely, however, on the work of skeptical scientists around the world. I quote them and I follow their work, as well as reading the work and the studies of the proponents of man-made warming. Vaclav Klaus, the president of the Czech Republic, said there really are no experts in climate change. Being an expert in climate change is like being an expert in human behavior. So I put myself as a person who studies the whole topic and tries to bring the correct information to people.
Indeed. Now, would you say that it's a very complicated issue? Do we have limited understanding of climate change? Because, I mean, let's face it, when we try to monitor this both from a scientific point of view and then looking at what's being written in the media, there is a lot of back and forth. There is a lot of conflicting scientific reports. Maybe we could rephrase, though. We might want to say that it's actually the interpretation and consequent presentation of the scientific data where the discrepancy is, Steve. How would you clarify that?
I would agree. It is the interpretation of the data that differs. And if I can run on for a minute, Earth's climate is very complex. It's shaped by powerful forces from the solar system, the atmosphere, the oceans, and the land. And, for example, sunlight falls directly on the equator and the tropics and indirectly on the polar regions. All weather on Earth is driven by this differential in heat absorption between the tropics and the poles. Storm fronts, hurricanes, the jet stream, ocean currents, all redistribute heat from the tropics to the poles. And then we have the oceans that have a powerful impact on Earth's climate. The oceans have 250 times the mass of the atmosphere and can contain more than 1,000 times the heat of the atmosphere. And then we have aerosols coming from volcanoes, volcanic dust from the deserts, pollen from plants, both on land and plants in the sea, all those things, and man-made emissions, of course, shape the climate. So it's a very complex picture, but today's climate scientists have focused, and indeed they've been obsessed, on carbon dioxide, a very small part of the whole picture, and a trace gas in our atmosphere. So I think a lot of this whole picture is not very well understood, as you mentioned. Yet the world has jumped to a conclusion and said carbon dioxide is what's shaping everything, which is really a little bit strange.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting. We've been asked to change a lot because of this, and to a large extent, the data is not only then the presentation or interpretation is conflicting, but there's a lot of elements to this that we'll get into. But what can you say about natural cycles of climate change as we've been, understanding it so far? As we've had several warming periods in the past, several cooling periods. This seems to be very natural, right?
Yeah, Earth's climate is driven by natural cycles, and there are all sorts of cycles. Just like people have daily cycles and monthly cycles in the way our bodies operate, the Earth is driven by cycles as well. And there are long-term, there are medium-term, and there are short-term cycles that scientists know about. The long-term cycles are what most scientists believe have caused the ice ages and the warm periods between the ice ages. And those are driven by tilt of the Earth's axis, the precession of the Earth's axis, changes in Earth's orbit, the effect of the sun and the planets. And those operate over 20 to 100,000 year sort of cycles. Then we have medium-term cycles, as Dr. Fred Singer and Dennis Avery have pointed out. They call it Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years is their book. And if you look back over the last 20,000 years, you see changes in temperature. First, Earth's temperature warms, and then it cools, and it warms. Now, these are a couple degrees Celsius changes we're talking about, smaller than the ice ages. But they capture the medieval warm period of 1,000 years ago when the Vikings settled southwest Greenland, and they formed a colony at Hovasi, grew to 5,000. They farmed, they raised livestock.
Yeah.
And then we entered a period called the Little Ice Age, not a true ice age, but a cool period from about 1300 to 1800, when the Thames River froze solid at London every year, and they had the frost fair right out on the ice. You can't do that today because the Thames hasn't frozen solid for over a century. So we have then intermediate cycles, and then we have short-term cycles. The best known probably is El Nino, which is an irregular temperature cycle in the Pacific Ocean. The El Nino Southern Oscillation, more completely, that happens every 3 to 7 years. And we have some longer cycles, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which for 30 years the North Pacific Ocean is warm, and then it's cool for the next 30 years, and then it's warm again. We have an Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation. We have a number of these cycles that occur all over the Earth. So the combination of the long and the medium and the short-term cycles is enough to fully explain the recent warming over the 20th century without having to resort in any way to carbon dioxide emissions.
Would you say that these are pretty much predictable at this stage, or are there other variables that could upset this kind of up and down pattern that we've seen in the past?
Some of them appear to be pretty regular. The best defined ones probably are the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which the North Pacific Ocean warmed from about 1910 to 1940, and then it cooled till about 1975, and then it warmed from about 1975 to about 2003 or 2005, and that was the period when all the scientists said, "Wow, we've got all this warming." Now that has moved into a cool phase again. Similarly, the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation is a regular cycle. Others are not so regular. El Nino in the Pacific is very irregular. And the longer cycles that formed the Roman warming 2,000 years ago and went into the cool cycle and then the medieval warm period and a little ice age, we're really not sure when those are going to change again, but it's possible we could move into another cool cycle in the medium term here.
Well, how long do you think that would go on, and what would be, it's of course impossible to know at this stage, but what kind of magnitude do you think that would be? Some people have speculated that we are pretty much heading into an ice age. Would you be that radical to claim that?
I don't know about the ice age thing. We have been actually the long-term cycles have averaged about 90,000 years of ice and about 10,000 years of warm period. And we're really running close to the end of one of the warm periods. I think what many scientists are predicting is that we're going to enter a period of moderate cooling because the Pacific Decadal Oscillation has moved into a cool phase, because the sun is less active in terms of sunspots and other solar activity. That appears to be a factor as well. So that the sun has moved into a little bit of a cool phase. And as meteorologist Joseph DeLeo has said, the last holdout is the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. The Atlantic temperature cycle is still in a warm phase, but in the next 5 years or so, that may turn cool. So it's very possible we could go into a 20-year or 30-year period of cool temperatures, 1 to 2 degrees cooler. If that's the case, it's going to get harder and harder for the climate models to talk their way out of what have been errors for the last 15 years in projections.
Indeed. So in the 1970s, there was a global cooling trend, or to talk about that at least, going on. Then it was global warming. Now they call it climate change, pretty much in order to attribute anything that is slightly anomalous weather-wise to the changing climate. But is the weather changing, or do you think that we're seeing more hurricanes and more anomalous weather at this time, Steve?
Well, I think the weather is always changing. I gave a presentation in California a little while back, and I said to them that, the Pacific Ocean, that huge thing just off to the west coast, which covers one-third of the Earth's surface and can contain all of the land masses within it with space left over, the Pacific Ocean is the biggest influence on California weather. And when that moves into a cool phase, then they tend to get a little bit drier in California, and they tend to get a little bit cooler. And it does affect storms, tornadoes, and hurricanes, even in the Atlantic Ocean. So we do have effect on storms from these major cycles. The real question is, the real issue is, though, are we seeing more extreme weather, which many organizations are saying? But if you look back over history, if you look at tropical storms, if you look at hurricanes, if you look at droughts and floods and other things, you really see that the events we've seen over the last 15 to 20 years are not different than what we've seen 50 or 100 years ago. They're very much the same, and they're not out of the range of natural variability.
Right. So we see a lot of this then being blamed on greenhouse gases, and I wanted to ask you to kind of what constitutes as greenhouse gases and what the role of CO2 actually is in this.
Yeah, So the theory of man-made warming basically says it's based on four principles. One is the greenhouse effect, and the greenhouse effect basically says that Sunlight enters our atmosphere as it does. It's absorbed by the surface of the Earth. Like any warm body, the surface of the Earth gives off lower energy infrared radiation. A little bit of that passes out into space, but much of that goes into the atmosphere, and it's absorbed by greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And then that infrared is re-radiated back to the surface of the Earth and elsewhere. And that is established science. That does tend to warm the surface of the Earth. There is a greenhouse effect. There's a few other things that the theory is based on. One is rising atmospheric carbon dioxide. One is rising temperatures. And the fourth is computer model projections. But to get back to the greenhouse effect, the thing that is rarely done and needs to be done is to break down the greenhouse effect and estimate how much is due to mankind. And so the first thing listeners need to know is that somewhere between 75 and 90% of Earth's greenhouse effect is due to water vapor and clouds, not methane, not carbon dioxide. The dominant greenhouse gas in our atmosphere is water vapor. And then, so if we're conservative and we say 75% due to water vapor and clouds, then the last quarter of Earth's greenhouse effect is due to carbon dioxide mostly, and some methane and other gases. But then the important question that needs to be asked, well, how much of that last quarter of Earth's greenhouse effect is due to man-made emissions versus natural emissions? Because the oceans have dissolved 50 times as much carbon dioxide as is in the atmosphere, and the oceans are always releasing carbon dioxide naturally and absorbing it. When plants grow, they absorb carbon dioxide. When they die, carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. And then we have volcanoes both above the surface of the ocean and about 10 times as many under the surface of the ocean, putting gases like carbon dioxide into the environment all the time. So when you wrap that all up, it turns out that the man-made portion of the greenhouse effect is only about 1 part in 100. 1% of the greenhouse of Earth's greenhouse effect is caused by man-made emissions. And that means that if we completely eliminated all emissions, we probably could not measure the difference in global temperatures. So that's really a key factor that your listeners need to know.
Indeed, and you had the quote on your website from Dr. Joseph DeLeo again, and he said, if the atmosphere was a 100-story building, the anthropogenic CO2 contributing today would be equivalent to the linoleum on the first floor. And then by comparison, water vapor, a far more potent greenhouse gas, on average would occupy, on average, one floor at a time, especially in the tropics, up to 4 floors. So that's not much at all, Danny.
Yeah, it's a big reason. So then the logical question is, well, how then do climate scientists, why do they think that we have catastrophic warming if man's only causing about 1% of the greenhouse effect? And I call it the flea wagging the dog theory. And they basically say that this trace gas carbon dioxide, by the way, there are only 4 of every 10,000 molecules in the atmosphere that are carbon dioxide, very small proportion. But climate scientists say that this trace gas, CO2, is now controlling the water cycle. And the theory basically says that as we put more CO2 into the atmosphere, we cause more of the greenhouse effect, the atmosphere heats up a little bit, and then the atmosphere absorbs and holds more water vapor because it's heated up. And because water vapor is the dominant greenhouse gas, that adds additional heating to the whole system. It's called the positive feedback. The problem, there's two problems with that. First is to say that a trace gas, carbon dioxide, is controlling the water cycle is really preposterous. The water cycle is huge. It encompasses all the oceans of the Earth. Again, 250 times the mass of the atmosphere. It encompasses weather. It encompasses the ice caps of Earth, which are frozen water. All of those flows, the forces involved in the water cycle are dramatically, many orders of magnitude bigger than the forces in the carbon cycle. So that's the first issue. It's a little bit implausible. And then the second one is that actual measurements have not shown that we're holding a lot more water vapor. Some measurements show we hold more in the lower atmosphere, but there are greenhouse effects in the upper atmosphere that are offsetting that. So the flea wagging the dog theory is what all these models are based on, and that's how they get to their alarming climate projections.
How do you think it was made possible then that many people believed that, you know, cars and CO2 emissions from industry, etc., is driving this primarily, as opposed to if we've seen these patterns, you know, in the past of ups and downs? It's only really in the last, you know, 50 maybe to 70 years that we've seen a change in industry and cars and everything else.
Yeah, two factors. The first is I think the world jumped to a conclusion. Back in 1988, Dr. James Hansen of NASA, who was a computer modeler, came before the United States Congress at the behest of Al Gore and others, and he testified that he was 99% certain that the Earth was warming and mankind was causing it. That very same year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed by the United Nations, and the UN wanted to be a world environmental leader. And within 1 year, the IPCC found that man was the cause of global warming. And then just 3.5, and by the way, many other scientists at the time said, well, we just don't know enough to make these projections or jump to these conclusions that man is driving climate change. But the news media was captured by the computer modeler scientists who said that they were 99% sure, and the guys who said, well, we don't, it's uncertain, didn't make any headlines. And then at the 1992 Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, 41 nations and the European community signed a treaty saying they would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So for the last 20 years now, our governments have been arguing about how much to reduce emissions and by when, but more and more science shows that natural effects are dominant. Clouds, weather, effect of the oceans driven by the sun, man-made influences are small. So that's the first thing. The world jumped to a conclusion. The second thing is that whole industries, careers, and many other things have been built up over these 20 years. Much of the system is being driven by money now, and so it's like a laden cargo ship. It has a huge amount of momentum. It'll take a very long time to turn around.
Well, exactly. And we hear, of course, all the time that it's a tremendous urgency and that there's no time to discuss this. You know, otherwise it'll be it'll run out of control. I mean, is there any risk that planet Earth would enter into any kind of, you know, runaway global warming as we see, for example, on Venus?
Well, you know, the changes are really very small. We're talking about this is really all about 1 degree here. I try and stay off of Venus and Mars because there's enough evidence on Earth to discuss the issue.
Sure. Yeah.
But we've only had about 0.7 degrees Celsius or 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit rise since 1880. That's very, very small in terms of the temperature changes in the past. The ice ages changed 7 to 12 degrees Celsius, all from natural occurrence. We've had these medium-term cycles that I measured. An example is there was a Roman warm period 2,000 years ago when you see the statues of those Roman soldiers wearing those little skirts. And at that time, they harvested olives in central Germany, and wines were commercially grown and sold in England.
That's right.
2,000 years ago. And so there were these warmer periods that occurred naturally, nothing to do with man-made emissions. And we've really seen a very small change, 1 degree over the last 150 years, and that's what all the hubbub is about.
Well, and then at the same time, we have the media, at least, is giving us an impression that there is a consensus pretty much among scientists. This is irrefutable now, when there really isn't such a thing as consensus. You, for example, have many scientists that you list in your book that you derive much of your research from, and you know these are Henrik Svensmark from out of Denmark, you know Roy Spencer, William Hopper. The list goes on and on there, of course. But so how is this managed, do you think, if we get into the politics and the media of this a little bit?
Yeah, it really is astonishing. Again, the world jumped to a conclusion, and there's been a huge amount of money driving this. We have, just to give you an example, the United States government, spends about $9 billion a year for climate change research. And that money goes to the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, National Academy of Sciences, NASA, NOAA, all the major scientific organizations to study man-made climate change. And they take that money, much of it, and they give it to universities across the country in $1, $5, and $10 million chunks. And if a university says, well, I think the cause of climate change is primarily natural, not man-made, well, typically they don't get any funding for that sort of a position. And so we have this self-perpetuating thing, and we have all these computer models that are very expensive that require a team requires $10 or $20 million a year to support, and a big computer requires $50 million or more. NASA puts satellites up to study the climate that costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And by the way, there's many scientists or astronauts, once they leave NASA, come out of the closet and say, well, they don't believe man's causing climate change. But when they're with NASA, you know, they play ball. They need that next satellite or they need whatever. So we have really a strange situation what's going on here. And really remarkable.
How would you say, let's say we could talk about some of the major spokespeople for climatism and how you believe they managed to get so successful at, I guess, tipping the scales. I mean, you mentioned that earlier, the Earth Summit in Rio back in 1992. And then, by the way, they had a 20 years reunion of that meeting in, you know, last year, 2012, for that conference. But I see it goes back, you know, to the Club of Rome, for example, back in the 70s, mm-hmm. Limits to Growth, etc. How far back do you go on this?
Yeah, I think you're right. Back in the 1970s, you know, well, we had a conservation movement in the United States for many years prior to that, but the with the advent of the nuclear bomb and the spawning of the environmental organizations, Greenpeace and others, in the 1970s, the environmental movements took hold. The Club of Rome wrote Limits to Growth in the 70s. We had Dr. Paul Ehrlich talking about the population bomb in the 70s. And many of these folks have gone on and to support and write about this idea that man's causing dangerous climate change. And it seems like this has caught the fancy of many in the public, even though many of the predictions that had occurred had been proven false. But we have many folks that have staked their fame on this. I mean, former Vice President Gore has, I think, left office, according to the press, with about $5 million net worth, and now he's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Dr. James Hansen has become the leading scientific spokesman for the theory of man-made warming and has been very successful. Tim Flannery in Australia wrote a couple books. I think one sold a total of 1 million copies. The Weathermakers, which talked about the coming catastrophe and the coming weather catastrophe. So it has been a path to success for many in the climate alarm camp, if you will.
Later, I want to get into some of the things of what we're asked to change, of course, you know, lifestyle changes and things, the mm-hmm. industry and everything and the money behind it. But before we leave some of the other topics there, let's discuss a few more of these items that we hear about, like, you know, we have sea level rise, for example, the ice levels there. I mean, I've been reading articles. One day we're talking about receding ice caps. It's catastrophic. The next day, I see a report, an article coming out of England that talks about how much they've grown in the last year. There's an immense discrepancy here.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on both sides, really. So sea level rise basically is the greatest tragedy forecasted by climatism. And it basically says that as the Earth warms, the oceans will expand and the ice caps will melt. And when they melt, the ocean will rise. And with that rise, there's a potential for catastrophic flooding of Bangladesh, of Holland, of Florida, San Francisco, other places around the world. And very large predictions have been thrown about. James Hansen and Al Gore have talked about a 20-foot rise by the year 2100, 6-meter rise. That sort of rise would be a catastrophe for many of the cities of the world. But to examine that, we really need to look at the three of Earth's ice caps and see what's happening. So the first is the North Pole. And satellite data shows that North Pole ice has been in decline for the last 30 years. And this has been called the canary in the coal mine, the idea that a trace gas must be causing this. Three things listeners need to know about the North Pole. One is that Arctic ice comes and goes. It's been low in the past, like in the 1920s and other times. It comes and goes naturally. Second, that Arctic ice is floating on the Arctic Ocean, and you can do a little experiment at home. You just put ice and water in a glass, measure the level before and after the ice melts, and you'll see there's no change. A floating ice does not raise water level when it melts, so even if all of the Arctic ice melted, it would not affect the sea levels. But third and most important is that Arctic ice is only about 1 to 2% of Earth's ice. And, okay, well, 1 to 2% has been declining, but what about the elephant? And the elephant is Antarctic ice, which is 90% of Earth's ice. And it's interesting that the same satellite data shows that Antarctic sea ice has been expanding for 30 years. As Arctic ice has been melting, the South Pole ice has been expanding, and that's very underreported in the press.
Right.
And one of the interesting photos I have in my book is a picture of the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. Scientists have maintained a presence at the South Pole since the 1950s. And the Amundsen Scott Station is the third station that the world has had down there. And I always ask audiences when I present, well, do you know what happened to the other two stations? And the answer is that they were buried by ice. Because the South Pole is a desert, but it gets some snow, and every year it gets about a net accumulation of 8 inches. And then the next year it's 8 inches, and the next year it's 8 inches. And this has been happening for many years now. And so the Amundsen Scott Station is built in seven modular buildings, and they're all sitting on stilts. And so every year, as the snow accumulates, they just jack these stations up over the accumulating snow. So this is what's happening at the South Pole. 90% of Earth's ice, the ice is getting thicker on the Antarctic land, and the sea ice around Antarctica has also been increasing for 30 years. The last 8 to 9% is Greenland, which is always a favorite on TV. They always show the water pouring into the crevice like it's some sort of unnatural event.
Right.
But temperatures in Greenland means that the ice freezes in the winter and it melts in the summer. It's right in the middle. And if you look overall at Greenland, it's losing ice near the edges. It's getting thicker in the center like South America. So overall, Earth's ice caps are stable. And if we look back at history, sea level rise has been about 7 to 8 inches per century over the last 150 years. And so the idea that we're going to have a 20-foot rise is very unlikely, and it's only based on computer model projections.
Migration, I mean, has more or less been a constant in human history, and it's not that long that we've, of course, had many of the mega cities that we have right now, but adaptation to new circumstances, geologically speaking, seems to have been the standard in the past, if you will. Do you think that any of these efforts is about trying to freeze, if you will, no pun intended, the conditions around the climate that we're trying to, I mean, not that we would have the power and ability to do that, but that this is an attempt to try to level out those natural ups and downs of the climactic cycle. What do you think?
Well, the first thing you mentioned is adaptation and migration, and I think that is the sensible policy, is to adapt. Obviously, mankind has to react to storms and rise. Oceans are going to continue to rise. Oceans have risen about 390 feet in the last 20,000 years, according to NASA. They're going to continue to rise. Mankind needs to adapt. But this idea that we can mitigate carbon dioxide and we can control the climate is really flawed. And there's also an idea that you touch on. One of the corollaries, I guess, of the theory of man-made warming is that climate has been stable for thousands and thousands of years, and temperatures have been unchanging, which is one of the things that's put forward. And so this recent 1 degree rise we've seen in the last 20th century is abnormal and therefore must be due to something that man is doing. But again, if we go back and look at those long and medium and short term cycles, we see that that is not the case, that climate is always changing.
So what about the sun driving the changes that we see as well? We have, for example, as an extra addition to that, cosmic rays, as Svensmark's research shows, you know, consequently, that's creating cloud coverage, it's believed, and affecting temperature ups and downs more than, you know, anything else, pretty much.
Yeah, that's a very interesting theory, which just arose about 5 or 10 years ago. Scientists at the Danish Space Research Institute, led by Henrik Svensmark and others, noticed that there was a very high correlation. They've known for many years that cosmic rays affect cloud cover. But one of the things they found was that there's a strong correlation with low clouds. In other words, and it's an inverse relationship. The more cosmic rays we have coming in, let me make sure I can get this right here now. Well, I guess that's not right. The higher the level of cosmic rays, the higher level of low clouds. And
yeah, it's interesting this theory because it's kind of, at first, it's kind of counterintuitive as you go through it. Like, wait a minute. But then it makes sense after you realize what's going on there. Yeah.
Right. Well, and they also noticed that sunspots also affected the level of cosmic rays. The thing that we've known for many years. And so Svensmark put together the theory saying basically that sunspots, when they occur on the sun, actually change the climate on Earth. And it's a little bit of a convoluted sort of thing. Basically, when we have a lot of sunspots on the sun, the sun's solar magnetic field that reaches out is strong, and it blocks cosmic rays. And Svensmark found that cosmic rays, when they hit the Earth's atmosphere, stimulate cloud formation.
Right.
So if cosmic rays are blocked, that means we get less clouds, that means we get more sunlight, and we end up with global warming. And if the sunspot activity is weak, then we get more cosmic rays, more low clouds are formed, and we get global cooling. And this theory is gaining strength. Experimentally, it seems to fit. But it's something that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has not taken into account and has criticized, but it may very well be the most important way that the sun is affecting climate on Earth over short periods.
Indeed. What are we asked to change then? Maybe we can talk about some of the, well, you have basically 7 major lifestyle changes listed, detailed in your book as you see it, Steve.
Yeah, there are many things that the climate has asked of everyone, things that are needed to do to save the planet, and those include changing our vehicles, electrifying them, or getting on high-speed trains rather than aircraft. They include decarbonizing our homes. They include changing our diet. Many folks want us to all become vegetarians. They include greening our business and decarbonizing our business and our universities, skipping air travel because there's really no good alternative to that. And then finally, our family as well. If you have more children, they each have a carbon footprint, and so they add to the problem. So fewer children is better. And finally, changing our government and our economy. Many say that we have to get rid of democracy, we have to get rid of capitalism, those are the only ways that we can save the planet. So there's a huge amount of changes there that are demanded, correct this global warming, which may really be a non-problem or something that we cannot control in any way anyway.
Yeah, I find it interesting that it's been so much, you know, politics. Well, everything is political in a sense, I guess. But in this case, how much it's taken over this particular field. I always go back to the situation when we were in Copenhagen back in 2010 at the COP15 meeting, and became apparent there. We did a little short, you know, TV episode on this, and I was just amazed at. All right, I mean, we're in Europe, we're in Northern Europe, but I was amazed about how many hammers and sickles there were at these parades. And I mean, they had them in the shape of windmills and very clever, you know, and all this. But do you think that political ideology managed to get so infested into the climate debate and, you know, all thing that's, you know, considered to be green and all that?
Yeah, there is. James Dellingpole has written an excellent book called Watermelons, where he talks about how the socialist and the communist movements, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and other things that went on, many of those folks moved into the environmental arena and concentrated on the issue of man-made warming. And there were even some, I think, and I'm forgetting a name or two here, but there's some very prominent people from the former communist persuasion that have headed up environmental groups. You know, I try not to get too much into criticizing individual environmental groups, that sort of thing. I like to stick to the science facts and the economics of renewables and policies. That's where the real key is.
Oh, definitely. To me, it seems like a lot of what's been interesting to see the debate has changed into really about control, if you will. I mean, in the next segment here, Steve, I want to get into more about, you know, global governance and all the things that are, you know, kind of arranging themselves as a political infrastructure around this. And it seems to me that they're piggybacking on the environmental question. And at this stage, as I mentioned before, we're to a large extent asked not to examine this question anymore because the time has run out. If we don't act now, it's over. That's kind of the plan here, it seems like, right?
Yeah, very much so. And as you say, many groups have used this whole idea of man-made warming to accomplish various ends.
Indeed. Now, before taking a break, let's talk a little bit more about you know, some of your books that you have out there, your website, and we want to give out some details to people that want to find out more about how to get involved. You do lectures and stuff like that as well, I believe, quite a bit, right?
Yeah, I'm a public speaker on the topic. I speak to various industry groups and try and tell them the real science and the real economics behind all these issues. All those groups that are out there counting their carbon footprint, which really isn't of high value, except maybe from a public relations point of view. But I've also written two books. One is Climatism, Science, Common Sense, the 21st Century's Hottest Topic, a 400-page hardcover book, and then most recently, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism, which is a color paperback, and I call it the first book on climate change that's fun to read. And those are available from my website, climatism.net, or on Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Very good. Climatism.net. We're going to have that linked up. Check out some of the books there as well. And much more I want to ask you about, of course. We'll get into that in the second segment, including, you know, government's involvement in other, you know, so-called renewable sources of energy and kind of the government subsidies in that field and everything else. But we'll take a short break here, Steve. So stay with us, and we'll be right back with more.
Look around, for we love your own.
So in the second segment, we'll go into the claims of overpopulation if human beings are a virus on the planet. We'll examine the new green economy, cap and trade, and such other scams. Later, Steve tells us what he thinks about renewable sources of energy, fracking, big surprise there, and global governance as well as an extension to that. To continue to listen, go to redicemembers.com and log in or sign up for a membership if you're not yet a member. We have a vast archive of extraordinary material that we hope will help you to widen your perspective, learn more about yourself, and of course the world that we live in. We have no commercial interruptions, no website ads. We are listener supported, so if you like it, please support it. Thank you. All right, some of our upcoming guests include Jason Erb, Mark Passio, Brian Kennard, Mike Mitchum, Jesse Ventura, and many more. All right, we'll talk to you more in the second hour. Thank you so much for staying with us.